Okay, thanks.
Sure.
You have to
so, again, my talk will follow a handout, only the first two pages of the handout. The other pages are pure propaganda about talks I've given in the past. And maybe I'll start by apologizing about this one. So, basically, last year I gave the other talks on this booklet too many times and I got tired of it. And then I almost decided not to come here because I just couldn't bear repeating it. And then Jürgen told me to come anyway. So I'm talking about a weak result that hopefully will become stronger later. And again, my apologies for that. But on the other hand, we can take it as good news. The fact that it's weak means that you can find people, your students can make it stronger. Because it's not clear that I will be able to do it, okay? And basically the result is the following. So there is something called BF quantum field theory. It has a Lagrangian. It leads to perturbation theory. You write Feynman diagrams. I can compute them for some. So that they're supposed to give you invariants of two knots. And I can compute them completely explicitly for some two knots, namely for ribbon two knots, and then for non-ribbon two knots, it's your exercise to finish the computation. Okay? Before I really start, let me continue what Slingerland did. So at some point he showed us a video over here of a diver doing something with bubbles. So let's do it again. I hope it will work. Here you go. Can you all see? So this diver just did a two-dimensional braid in R4 because you see a flying ring, the space-time trajectory of it is a tube in R4, and what we just saw was two such tubes interacting. Now that was a ribbon braid in R4 because it was made out of rings that stay unknotted throughout. Now you can extend it a little bit and allow the rings to go up and then backwards in time. Much as in knot theory, you have strands that go up and then down in the z-coordinate. And then what you will get is ribbon two knots. These are the ones I understand. The ones I don't understand were done in the lab. So these are flying knots. Okay? And again, it's a vortexing fluid, can be implemented, but these I don't understand. Okay? And these are the general two knots. Okay, so, okay, so let's move on. Oh, but I should say something. There is actually a map from three-dimensional knot theory into four-dimensional knot theory, and it's called spinning. So basically, if you have a three-dimensional knot, and in fact, it sort of it generalizes to other types of knotted objects, tangles, etc. But basically, if you have a three-dimensional knot, you draw it inside a half space, okay? Where, well, this extends to infinity, but this is a half space on this side. And then maybe I draw it as a long knot, okay? And then you take this half space and spin it around this axis, okay? Like you spin a page in a book around the spine of the book, okay? And then what you get is each point of the original knot becomes a circle, and overall you get a knotted tube in R4, and it's always a ribbon tube, quite clearly, because it's made out of such circles, okay? So before telling you anything about two knots, I will tell you that, I mean, the computation that I am doing is quite weak, but nevertheless, when to two knots that come from the spinning of ordinary knots, I got formulas I didn't know before for an invariance that I did study before, and which is quite interesting. So let me tell you a little bit about these formulas, because they are pathetically easy. So you get pathetically easy formulas for an extremely interesting invariant. Okay? So first of all, I am using Gauss diagrams to represent knots. So if you have a knot, then its Gauss diagram is, well, you draw the skeleton of the knot, so it's a long line, the parameter space of the knot, and any two points on the parameter space that project to the same point in the image, you connect by an arrow. So so this point, this crossing here, corresponds to two points in the parameter space, this one and that one. So I've connected these by an arrow, and the convention is that the arrow goes from the overside to the underside, and it is marked by a sign. In this case, all signs were minus, and the sign comes from the sign of the crossing. Okay? And there is a similar notation for braid. So for example, this braid, the parameter space will be two lines. So here are these two lines, and the arrows are as shown, except I didn't bother to indicate their signs. So take any knot, write its Gauss diagram, and I'm going to give you a formula for an invariant valued in cyclic words in an alphabet T, which corresponds to the components of the, sorry, it should be a tangle, not a knot. I mean, one example of a tangle is a long knot, so it also restricts to knots, but it's more general. And, okay, so here's how you do it. So take your Gauss diagram. It's a different one than the one I've shown before, but here's a Gauss diagram. Three arrows, one of them has a sign. And replace every arrow by an exponential of red arrows. So in other words, do the summation over K, L, and M running from 0 to infinity of 1 over K factorial minus 1 to the L over L factorial, because chord L, because arrow L was marked with a minus sign, and then 1 over M factorial, and take the chord, sorry, the arrow corresponding to K, and make K copies of it, the arrow corresponding to L, and make L copies of it, and so on. So this describes the top half of the picture. You basically replace every arrow in the Gauss diagram by an exponential. Then, out of every arrow tail, so out of every arrow tail in the picture, you connect a line to the left, to minus infinity on the left. So you draw a line going to minus infinity on the left. And then each arrow head, you connect to one of the lines that go underneath it. Okay? And you sum over all possible ways of making such connections. This done, oh, maybe I should have said the same could be done for links or tangles. And the only difference is that now you will have two families of tails. The tails coming from the top strand and the tails coming from the bottom strand. So you will label the ones coming from the top strand by whatever label corresponds to the top strand, and you will label the ones coming from the bottom strand by another label. Okay? Now, the picture you now have here, you have a big sum of graphs. And these are oriented graphs. All edges are directed, and all the vertices are two in, one out, right? Because you have one black coming in, one red coming in, and one black coming out. So all the vertices are two in, one out. The only graphs you can make out of, two in, one out. Vertices are unions of trees that are superimposed on a single cycle. Basically, I should have added that these graphs only have tails going outside, so that their boundary is only incoming boundaries. So the only thing you can do is trees built on top of cycles. Okay? So now, interpret the element, the trees, as living in the Frilly algebra on a number of generators. Remember that the tails here are labeled by the components of the link. So interpret these trees as living in the Frilly algebra generated by the components of the link, and reduce vertices towards the wheel using using the fact that by interpreting vertices as brackets. So the bracket of A times B is AB minus BA. So if you have a vertex on top of the wheel, you replace it by, well, call the left side A, the right side B, so you replace it by A times B minus B times A. Okay? And then what you're left with is, so basically it's a reduction algorithm that turns trees over wheels into colored wheels, where the colors are the colors of the original component of the knot. So this whole procedure gives you a huge linear combination of colored wheels, and my claim, the theorem, or one theorem, is that this is an invariant of T-component tangles, and furthermore, it's a lovely invariant of T-component tangles. So it agrees with all the other handouts on the booklet, the ones I will not be talking about. It is computable in practice. So I actually have programs that use other algorithms to compute it to a very high degree. And the most important thing is that it contains the Alexander polynomial directly. So when you restrict your attention to knots, so to one tangles, the invariant is valued in wheels that have only one color. So the only parameter is the number of spokes. So it's really power series. And then it's a power series invariant, which is just a reparametrization of the Alexander polynomial. But if you go back to tangles, then, it is the essential part in the construction of the multivariable Alexander polynomial. Namely, there is a small variation of it that's actually a bit easier, that I don't want to show, along with it, it completely constructs the multivariable Alexander polynomial of a link, except that it is much more general. So the multivariable Alexander polynomial of a link is valued in commutative power series, and this will be valued in something non-commutative because the spokes, because cyclic words are essentially non-commutative objects. So it's some sort of non-commutative generalization of the Alexander polynomial. Is this still okay? Anyway, this is not yet the beginning of the talk. This is the real beginning of the talk. So, BF theory, as I said, it's a certain Lagrangian. It's happening in R4 for today. So I'll call it the manifold. The fields are one form, or more precisely a connection, but again, since I'm in R4, I'm allowing myself to call it a one form. So a one form with values in some Lie algebra, and a two form B with values in the dual of that Lie algebra. The Lagrangian is a function of these two, one form and two form, and it is the integral over the manifold of the field B paired with the curvature of A. And that's the only reason it's called BF. Okay? Now, So there are two types of observables. The easy ones are the ones that more or less correspond to Chern-Simons theory, and they have to do with taking the holonomies of A along a curve. And these I don't want to talk about. The more interesting ones are invariants that are associated, or are observables that are associated with an embedding of a sphere, or more precisely a pointed sphere, so I'll call it R2, into the manifold, or in fact, even more generally, a family of such spheres, so in other words, a two-link, okay, a two-dimensional link in R4. Now, you know, there's no such thing holonomy of a two-form, or I don't know how to define the holonomy of a two-form, and the clever things that Cataneo and Rossi did was that instead they introduced an internal two-dimensional quantum field theory that runs in the parameter space, that runs on R2 or on S, and using this two-dimensional quantum field theory, which in itself is a BF theory but slightly perturbed by the ambient BF theory, so using this internal BF theory, they construct an observable corresponding to such knot or link. Okay? Now, there isn't much point going through it because I will not have time to derive anything from it anyway, but the derivation is, well, is in their papers and is quite sophisticated. So there is lots of gauge symmetry. You have to fix the you have to fix the gauge symmetry. You do it by the BV formalisms. There are zero modes. They integrate out the zero modes. They do a lengthy process, and at the end of the day, they get a Feynman diagram description for the result. Yes.
Is this for any of the algebra, or is it transcendence theory? Is this just like SL2, or?
No. Everything I said so far applies for any Lie algebra. And the best thing to do is to forget the Lie algebra and work universally, and that's what I'll do in a minute. So in fact, kind of, this is sort of factored into the discussion that I don't do about how to go from the Lagrangian to the Feynman diagrams. So let me describe the Feynman diagrams. Or, you know, really, Cataneo and Rossi will tell us that the invariant is a certain exponential of a sum over Feynman diagrams, or the log of the invariant is a log of, the invariant is a certain sum over Feynman diagrams of an expression corresponding to each Feynman diagram, and then the log of the invariant, which I will call zeta, is a certain sum over Feynman diagrams of some messy expressions. But let me describe to you right away what are the Feynman diagrams in this theory. So, the Feynman diagrams are best drawn on top of a piece of the surface whose invariant we're trying to compute. So this is drawn here in green. So green is a certain two knot in R4, and you know, I mean, I made it flat so that I can draw things on top of it, but I also put a little kink at the end to hint to us that it's actually knotted. Okay? A Feynman diagram is a picture that looks like this, and let me describe the features that appear inside this picture. So it has air pieces. Air pieces are, well, or propagators. These are these red lines here. And you should be thinking of them as coming from the ambient BF theory, the four-dimensional BF theory. And it has ground pieces, and the ground pieces are always drawn in black, and they live on the surface, and they come from the internal quantum field theory, the two-dimensional quantum field theory that was used to construct the observable. Now, and then there are vertices. There are several types of vertices. There is an M vertex. So an M vertex will correspond to an integration over the manifold M, so an integration on R4, and on at the M vertex, three air pieces meet together to make a trivalent vertex.
So is there some transversality condition in this diagram? So they have touched the surface only one moment of it?
These diagrams are combinatorial.
Okay.
So, okay. I mean, I haven't yet turned them into expressions. Okay? But really, you should think, you should be thinking that eventually all the black points, all the S points will be embedded in the surface, and all the M points will be embedded in the manifold, and I will want all of these points to be distinct from each other. Okay? At least ones that are connected by an edge. Then there are, what other types of vertices I have here? I have a vertex in which a ground piece terminates at the beginning of an air piece. I have vertices in which two ground pieces meet and an air piece comes in to say hello to them. I have vertices in which a ground piece starts at the end of an air piece, and in such cases I add a little tail, which I will call a monk's tail, because monk's cats have tiny tails that are useless. Okay, they don't do anything except for being. Okay? And finally, there is, so basically the ground pieces make sort of serpents, make snakes, with heads in which a red piece starts, with middle pieces in which a red piece terminates, and with tail pieces in which a red piece terminates, and there is this little monk's tail. Okay? And I also allow the case where the serpent, where the snake is of length zero. So sometimes I will have a red piece starting on the manifold, and then I'm adding this little extra black piece, monk's tail, just for fun. Okay? The degree of such a diagram is the number of monk's tails. Okay? And if you think hard about what these diagrams look like, if you forget the colors, all the vertices are two in, one out. Okay? So it's again a diagram, topologically, combinatorially, it's again a wheel surrounded by trees that flow into it. And the tails also have these additional little pieces, and these little pieces will carry the color of the surface on which they lie. So this is, I'm drawing the case in which there is only one surface, but the diagram could connect between several such surfaces, and then each serpent will be lying on one individual surface because the ground pieces have to stay on the ground. And then the monk's tails will always have color corresponding to the surface they came from. Now, how do I make an expression out of such a diagram? So, basically, I integrate over all positions in R2, or, you know, in the case of several components, then each component is integrated over its own R2. Okay? So I integrate over several positions in R2, one for each S vertex. I integrate over several locations in R4, one for each M vertex. And then, and now each S vertex lies in some specific place on a surface which is in itself in R4. So each S vertex is in itself in R4. And each M vertex is in R4. So there is a direction of view going from this vertex to this vertex, and this direction of view is a point in S3, right? Directions in R4 are points in S3. So each edge here can be labeled by a point, or gets labeled once I integrate, gets labeled by a point in S3. And likewise, each ground piece gets labeled by a point in S1, because these two ends are in R2, and the direction between two points in R2 is a point in S1. So, pull back the volume form of the of S3 using whatever is written on each of the red edges. Pull back the volume form of S1 using whatever is written on each of the black edges. Wedge everything together and worry about signs in some other time. And what you get is a certain big form. Now, let's count dimensions very quickly. So, each M vertex corresponds to an integration in a four-dimensional space. So I write this 4 as 2, 1, 1. Okay? And each black piece corresponds to an integration on a one-dimensional space, sorry, a two-dimensional space, the surface, and I write this 2 as 1, 1, and 0 in the case of these vertices, or 2, 0 in the case of these, or 1, 1 in the case of these. Okay? And now, look at how I marked these numbers on the edges. So each black edge gets a single 1 and a single 0, so overall it has a 1 on it, and that's the form degree that it contributes. And each red edge has a 2 and a 1 on it, which adds up to 3, and that's the form degree that it contributes. So overall, the number of integrations is equal to the degree of the form, so I integrate, multiply the result by the diagram D itself, thought of as a tree on top of wheels, meaning thought of as a cyclic word, okay, because a tree on top of wheels is just a cyclic word, as I said before, and then I restrict my attention to connected diagrams, either by taking log or by just dropping all non-connected diagrams, and I call the result zeta. And this is the invariant. And it should be an invariant for physical considerations, because it came from a Lagrangian that does not depend on the topology, essentially. Yes?
So the automorphism of B, I mean, these diagrams, you had some like reactive calculations on them. Is this after you simplified it to the cyclic word form? Or
the automorphism is just the number of rotations of a cyclic, of a wheel, or it's a very light. Okay? Good. So the question is, compute this invariant. Okay? What is it, really? Okay? So before telling you what it is, I have to tell you what are two knots. Okay, how do you describe two knots? So one way to describe two knots is to think of them as surfaces. So actually, just like you know, how do you describe one knot in R3, you draw circles in the plane, and the gaps in these circles indicate places where the one knot dips into the third dimension. I mean, goes out of the plane to go behind. Okay? So in exactly the same way, one lovely presentation of two knots is to use surfaces in R4 and indicate which piece of surface is above which other piece of surface above in the four-dimensional sense, in the t-coordinates, by making little gaps. Okay? So this is, I suppose, sort of the simplest parallel of a crossing. So we have two surfaces, in R3 they cross, but I indicated that green is above blue in this picture by making a cut in blue. Okay? But there are actually also more complicated things that can happen. So, I mean, right, if you take a generic surface in R3, it's not only going to have double points, it's only also going to have triple points. And in fact, also so-called branch points. I think I'm not going to say anything about branch points, except here's the picture. Triple points, on the other hand, these are where three pieces of the surface intersect when projected to R3. And then again, you have to indicate the ordering, the heights of each one. So in this case, red is the uppermost because it is not cut at all. It is above green because it cuts green. Green in itself is above blue because it cuts blue, and blue is below everything because it gets cut by both. Okay? And then, once I have a surface like that embedded in R3, I can construct its Decker set. And its Decker set is the analog of what I called before the Gauss diagram. So the Decker set will be when you take the parameter space of the surface, so in our case, a union of several copies of R2, because I was talking about a link, or maybe if you're talking about the two nodes and a single copy of R2. Okay? So you take these two-dimensional surfaces, and on the two-dimensional surfaces, you mark the points that in the image correspond to intersections. Okay? So, corresponding to this crossing, you will have two pieces on the parameter space, the piece parameterizing the green side and the piece parameterizing the blue side. So I've drawn them as light green and light blue. You can barely see it, but it's supposed to be light green and light blue. Okay? And on light green, I observe a line in which blue is below me. Okay, if I'm on the surface and I'm walking on light green, I at some point will see blue right below me. And since it's below and I have to look through the surface, I see it as a dashed line. Okay? And likewise, when I walk on blue, at some point I see above me a green surface. And again, but now I mark it as a full line. And really, these are paired. Okay? So, overall, I have a Decker set, which is a union of curves which are partially dotted and partially full, and these curves are paired because each singular point has two pre-images. Okay? Except there will also be vertices. So, when you're talking about the triple point, well, the triple point in the parameter space corresponds to three chunks, a light red chunk, a light green chunk, and a light blue chunk, and this is what you see on each one of them. And then there is something similar for the branch points. These are pictures by Carver and Saito, by the way. And Banach is unrelated, but he's in the... Okay? Why did I tell you all that? Because, well, I wanted to show some examples. Just so that you appreciate that two knots actually exists. So here's a two knot. Okay? This two knot is actually a knotted sphere. I challenge you to check that it's a sphere. And again, it's indicated which part is above which other part by putting cuts appropriately. And since I want all my knots to actually be base, I picked an arbitrary point, so this whole picture is by Carver and Saito, except I've added this tail to connect it to infinity. Okay? And the Decker set for this is the following. So I suppose let's start from the tail, Okay, so the tail means I start from infinity. Okay, so if I start from infinity, I first thing I see is crossing number 4. And in crossing number 4, I go below something. So I see something above me. So I see a circle made of a full line, and it's marked 4 because it is paired with some dotted line somewhere inside. Okay? And then I keep moving and I get to 3, and in 3 I go under something. Okay? So 3 is a dashed circle, but you see, every way to go from infinity to the rest of the surface will pass through 3. So 3 is sort of a big circle, whereas 4 was small. And it's a big circle that surrounds all the rest of the action, and I will not describe the rest of the action because I think it's more or less clear. Is it? Okay. So here's another example. So this is a four-dimensional knot whose coordinates I got from Esther Galvey. And well, this is the knot, but to make it clearer, I've drawn only half of it. Okay, I've cut it in half, it's like a shell, and I've only shown the lower half. And here, the fourth dimension is indicated by color. So red, so T is temperature. Red is hot, so it's high, and blue is cold, so it's low. So I mean, there are apparent intersections here, but they're not really intersections. Okay. So, first of all, here is a symbolic way of drawing this knot. I suppose, okay, so what I'll do is, okay, so this is a sphere, quite clearly. But I write this sphere as being a long, long tube capped on both ends. So, the cap on this end, I'll draw as a big bullet. And then, I suppose this end, the other cap is the one that will connect to infinity, so I'll draw it as a small bullet with a line going to infinity. And then the blue lines here indicate tubes. So you see, I mean, really, this is one big tube kind of curved on top of itself. And the convention for this kind of drawings, which are, by the way, called W knots, is that when you have a crossing in the picture, in the plane, in this diagrammatic representation, then the upper side corresponds to a wide tube, as shown here. This is this wide tube. And the lower side corresponds to a narrow tube. And the narrow tube penetrates through the wide tube twice. First time above four dimensionally, and then it exits below four dimensionally. And don't ask me which side is above, which side is below. There is some convention, and I please don't ask. Okay? So any picture like this, in fact, any picture of an ordinary knot represents a two-dimensional knot in R4 using these conventions. Okay? And on the other hand, any such picture corresponds to a Gauss diagram, except this Gauss diagram is also marked here with a point that goes to infinity and a point that goes to and an end which is capped. So it's infinitesimally different, but only infinitesimally. And actually there are signs, but I'm not showing you, I'm not telling you what they are. And there is a theorem which is conceivably due to Kazuhiro, or maybe it's due to your collaborators, Kanenobu, Shima. Okay, so there is a theorem which says that every ribbon knot in four dimension has a, well, not quite a presentation like that, but has a corresponding Gauss diagram. So some Gauss diagrams like this do not come from a picture. But every ribbon two-knot has a presentation in terms of Gauss diagrams like this. Okay, so I think the theorem is usually stated in maybe slightly different language. But...
I don't remember whether I did this or not.
Okay. Anyway, it's at least very close to things that you've done.
I did something related to this.
Yeah, yeah, it's very close to things that you've done, if it's not identical. Anyway, but then there is yet another, so now let me describe how to get the Decker set out of a Gauss diagram. So from the Gauss diagram, I can get the Decker set directly using what I would call the Riemann-Sydow representation. So so really, this stands for a plane. This blue line is a plane, because this blue line is a tube, and it's capped on one end, and the other end is capped, is close to infinity, is connected to infinity, goes to infinity. So this looks like a big, big, big cigar. And on this cigar, there are four sides. One side corresponding to this tail, and this is this side. One side corresponding to this tail, and it is this side. Another one corresponding to this head. Sorry, this one was the head. Basically, there are four special sides. And in these special sides, each one corresponds to two circles on the node, right? Each crossing here corresponds to an arrow here and to two singularities on the node. So each side on the cigar is made out of two circles, and the circles that correspond to tails, you can check, are small circles, one dashed, one full, and the circles that correspond to heads are circles that go all around the cigar. And again, one is dashed and one is full, and then there is a pairing between these circles as indicated by the diagram above. Is this clear? So the same thing can be done for links. So a picture like this represents a two link. The corresponding arrow Gauss diagram is this, and the corresponding ribbed cigar presentation actually involves two cigars and some circles marked on them. Are we okay? And now I can state the theorem. Oops, sorry, I wanted to say something more. This actually completely describes ribbon two knots, and that's the only part I understand. So I'll say a few words about the part I don't understand before stating the theorem. So if you were to talk about arbitrary two knots, you'll be talking about surfaces as shown here with moves between them that are sort of the parallels of the Rademeister moves, except that there are seven of them and they're called the Roseman moves, and they will correspond to moves on the Decker set, which are hell to manage, and that's what I failed. Okay? Furthermore, so in fact, I basically only understand the case where there are no crossings on the Decker set, so no triple points on the knot and no branch points. So only this case I can tell you something about. But again, it's big enough to contain ordinary knot theory. And one last thing before the theorem. So one problem with this, with trying to extend it to two knots, is that the simplest two knot that is not a ribbon two knot, and that I know, is shown here. It's a picture drawn by Carver and Saito, Carver Kanada Saito, and it's very hard to even see what it is, but that's the simplest example one would have to work with, so that's part of the difficulty. Okay, anyway, now I can state the theorem. And the theorem came up when I was sitting in Alberto Cataneo's office once, and we talked about it for about an hour and agreed that everything should work, once meaning a few months ago. So the credit is shared with Cataneo, but if there are any mistakes, all the blame is on me. And the theorem is, the algorithm described before actually computes the integrals also described before. Okay? Proof, or rather a sketch of the proof. So I'm beginning to run out of time, so it will be a sketch of the proof. So in four dimensions, right, I have to choose volume forms on S3. I have to use the volume form of S3 in order to write the integral. But you can show that the result is independent of the volume form. So take a volume form in which all the volume is concentrated on the sort of four-dimensional south pole. So basically, the only way a red propagator could contribute is if its tail is on the dashed line of a Decker set and its head is on the full line of a Decker set. So basically the only contributions come from the crossings. Okay? In that case, well, you can further show that the M trivalent vertices do not contribute. Basically, for a 3D trivalent vertex to contribute, right, a 3D trivalent vertex will involve three propagators, so you will need at least three layers. Since the propagator goes directly down, you need to have at least three layers in order to get a contribution, and since I'm restricting my attention to ribbon knots, you'll never have that. Furthermore, okay, so all that remains is to integrate along these dashed and circle lines, and you have points that run in parallel, that run concurrently, right? One point runs on the dashed line and one point runs on the full line, and they run together as the vertical propagators run along the intersection lines. But these points are connected to each other with black propagators. But what do black propagators measure? They measure the winding number of one point around the other. So the only way you can get a contribution from the piece, from the ground pieces, which are chains of black propagators, is if these black propagators connect as shown here. So you have a black propagator connecting to the tail of a red propagator that goes somewhere else, okay? And basically you have these nested contours. The only way you will get the contribution is if these black contours are nested. Sorry, I'm a bit rushing. But now if you look at the combinatorics of those nested ground snakes is exactly the same as the combinatorics shown here. So basically you replace this by, you replace the blue line by a cigar, and the only way you can put sort of serpents on the ground with heads on a dashed line and basically fitting all the rules is so that these are these snakes shown here. And that's essentially the end of the proof. Okay? And sorry, I mean, or at least that's essentially the end of the sketch of the proof. Okay? But now I have a few musings, a few further points I would like to mention. Okay? So, first one is, I wish I had understood plane curves a little bit better. Arnold has a book in which he describes a certain class of invariants of plane curves, some people here might have seen these pictures before because the book had some good readership. But his invariants are essentially coming from integrals on the plane similar to the ones I'm studying. So in order to understand the more complete picture, where you have big messy curves like here, like here, you will probably need a fuller understanding of this Arnold picture, and I don't have it. Next, and then I have to say a few faster points. So first of all, when BF is restricted to ribbon knots, and ribbon knots are really, or some of them are the images of three-dimensional knots, you get the same result as in Chern-Simons theory, which is three-dimensional. I don't know why. Maybe somebody here does. Second, I'm actually not sure that Cattaneo and Rossi captured everything that could have been written using these propagators. So for example, there is this, what I call the V variant. V here is / VEE, not the English letter V. So the V invariant is what you get when you get two red propagators meeting on a surface and having their tails on other surfaces. And it's not inside, it's not coming from BF, but it is written using the same propagators. It's clearly an invariant. It's easy to show that it is an invariant. It's an invariant of three component links. And if I had time, I would tell you why it's the true triple linking number, better than the minimum new 1, 2, 3, in some sense. So basically, the defining property of the linking number, one of the defining properties of the linking number, is that it's additive. If you have a component and you cut it in two, then the linking number with the sum is equal to the linking number with the left half plus the linking number with the right half. The three-dimensional thing that has the parallel property is this. So in some sense, this is a true triple linking number. Anyway, it does not fit within the BF theory, and I don't understand it. Next, so you see, when you talk about two-dimensional knots, you can be thinking about either of two things. You can be thinking either about embedded surfaces or about generic immersions. In three dimensions, it's the same. A generic immersion of a curve into R3 is an embedded. But in four dimensions, it's not the same. A generic immersion will have double points, and using my conventions of hiding and not hiding pieces, that's what a double point looks like. Okay? So it may be that the right objects to study in four dimensions is knots rather than knots. Where knots are things that have these, so generic immersions. And it might be that this is why I am failing with what I'm about to try to tell you that I'm trying to do. Ooh, I'm out of time. Maybe I'll say that the questions are, what are finite type invariants? There is a beautiful, and I wish I had time to tell you about it, way of suggesting what finite type invariants should be in R4. I know that the invariants I've described are finite type in this four-dimensional sense. I know that BF theory produces finite type invariants in this sense, but I cannot analyze this sense in the same way that three-dimensional finite type invariants are analyzed. And perhaps the reason is because I don't understand knots. And then the last bit is that in three dimensions, you know, you might want to try to analyze three-dimensional knots by sort of trying to think of what happens near a crossing. So look at the final diagrams coming from Chern-Simons theory, and you restrict your attention to the small neighborhood of a crossing. That fails, because somehow faraway parts of the knot do influence individual crossings. However, their influence on individual crossings can be summarized by just studying sort of all the rest of the knot, thinking of it as being one sort of circle at infinity. And you end up finding that you can completely recover the Chern-Simons integral, the Chern-Simons invariant, by restricting your attention to studying pictures like this one, which are not quite crossing. It's a trivalent graph embedded in R3 with sort of a shielding around the crossing. And in fact, a picture like this is really the same as a tetrahedron, and its invariant is exactly what is called the Dreamfield associator. I'm summarizing, you know, hours of work into 1 minute now. The three-dimensional analog, the four-dimensional analog of that would be to try to study invariants of things like this and that, and I have no clue how to do that, and if you have a clue, let me know, and I'll stop with my normal propaganda 5 minutes late, sorry. Yeah, thank you very much. Are there comments or questions?
You mentioned the missing factor in Levine's factorization. So I'm familiar with this paper. So what is your claim there?
So Levine has a paper in which he writes the multivariable Alexander polynomial of a link as the product of two factors. One factor is a certain determinant constructed out of minor linking numbers. The other factor, he just calls it theta, I think, and I don't think he ever gives it a direct interpretation or construction. It's just, it exists. Okay? So he says there is a factor theta such that this determinant of minor linking numbers times theta is the multivariable Alexander polynomial. That in itself has consequences because it means that the left-hand side vanishes in the same places as the right-hand side and consequences of that nature, but he doesn't interpret theta. Theta is the abelianization of this invariant. So this invariant is an invariant valued in cyclic words in letters that don't commute. If you make these letters commute, then cyclic words become just monomials, and then you get a power series valued invariant. So a reduction of this is this missing factor in Levine factorization. Or not missing, but uninterpreted factor. I mean, does it make sense, or are you suspicious?
No, I have thought about things like this, so I'm sort of familiar with this.
Okay, so basically, this is a direct construction of the wheels part.
Yes, absolutely.
Of and it's pathetically easy. You have to agree. Please agree.
Yes, no, I agree with this.
Okay?
And wheels and trees, right?
What?
Trees are in the middle part.
Yeah. And the trees are not shown here, but there is a similar way to get the trees as well. But it's sort of pathetically easy. That's the okay.
You said this gives the Alexander polynomial in the case of not up to a reparametrization. How does this look like, or is this too difficult?
No, it's very easy. I take the Alexander polynomial. It's a polynomial in some variable z t. I don't know. Put t equals e to the x. And then you get a power series in x, and the coefficient of x to the n is the coefficient of the n spoke wheel that you get here.
Okay, easy. Yeah. You said the second thing I want to ask is the expression of Kanye-Rossi, this Feynman sum with these expressions.
This?
Yes. I thought that this should be an invariant because of. Is it an invariant or should it be?
You know, I claim weakness and stupidity, but and semi-rigor. But in as much as I could tell, so okay. To prove invariance, you usually when you compactify configuration space, you look at the boundary pieces. And you look at the contributions coming from the boundary pieces, and the naive, the principal boundaries all cancel as expected, so it appears to be an invariant. But configuration space integrals tend to sometimes have anomalies that come from like hidden faces in the configuration. integration spaces. I haven't gone through this. Now, I don't expect any difficulties. So, I mean, I think it will work, if only because it works for ribbon knots. How will this integral know? These integrals know if a knot is ribbon or not. There's just no mechanism to decide if a knot is ribbon or not locally. Again, unless you've chosen the axial gauge and projected it to the plane, to R3. But there is no way. So if it works for ribbons, and for ribbons I can compute and get an answer, because there's no way it will not work for arbitrary two knots. Well, but I'm not trying to intimidate you, I'm being sincere to you, I'm trying to intimidate the knot into submission. You know? But again, let me pretend that all of these weaknesses are actually good news.
More questions or comments? Very well. So let's first thank Tor again.